From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Civil unrest erupted across the nation in the days following Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. President Lyndon Johnson ordered tens of thousands of federal troops onto the streets of Washington, Chicago, Baltimore, and other cities where crowds overwhelmed local police. The Fair Housing Act of 1968 was signed by Johnson the following week.
Now with this bill, the voice of justice speaks again. It proclaims that fair housing for all who live in this country is now a part of the American way of life.
That act proposed ending housing discrimination based on race, gender, religion, or nationality. 50 years later, we visited towns and cities across Georgia and heard over and over again that rapid development and rising housing costs have kept neighborhoods effectively segregated. Dan Immergluck is here to talk about the impact of that landmark legislation, particularly whether it's fulfilled its intent here in Georgia. He's professor in the Urban Studies Institute at Georgia State University. And Dan, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So this was in the works. It was a culmination of the Civil Rights Act when the Fair Housing Act had been discussed in the legislature. It was a key initiative of Dr. King. So what was the case being made for the Fair Housing Act?
Well, the case was both one of racial equity and economic equity, that given the urban unrest and basically the accumulation of evidence that African Americans in particular could not live where they wanted to live, that we needed a very clear law that said racial discrimination and some other kinds of discrimination in the housing market, whether it's rental or home buying, was illegal.
So had any protections existed before it passed?
Really very little. There was a 19th century law that supposedly protected against discrimination just in home buying. It was never enforced. It was basically rejected by the Supreme Court when it was attempted to be used.
It was not an easy piece of legislation to pass. Here is historian Michael Beschloss on NPR discussing Johnson's push for the Fair Housing Act. Opposition from his aides said no.
And they said, why don't you just defer civil rights until 65 once you're safely reelected? And Johnson, to his great credit, said, what the hell is the presidency for if I can't use it for civil rights?
Why, Dan, was the Fair Housing Act so controversial?
Well, this is about where people live. And also, when it's about where people live, it's who goes to school with you and your kids. And, you know, both Johnson and King, Dr. King, both acknowledged that voting rights is difficult, employment rights is difficult, other civil rights are difficult, but perhaps the hardest was housing and where people were able to live.
Well, housing also involves a market, and it was vehemently opposed by real estate companies. How did they, lenders, other opposing parties, uphold segregation in housing?
Well, we have a long history of segregation by market actors. We have redlining going back to the 19th century, where certain neighborhoods are basically color-coded by lenders and no lending is done there, where African Americans are not made loans. That was then reinforced by the Federal Housing Administration in the 1930s and going on, where even the federally insured loans would not be made to folks of color generally or into neighborhoods with even diverse racial characteristics.
Even the GI Bill, from what I understand, would not be in effect for
The GI Bill was definitely racially skewed. We put public housing predominantly in African American neighborhoods. There are all kinds of ways local governments use what we call exclusionary zoning to keep lower-income people out of their neighborhoods. So it was this mix of private and public discrimination that was so powerful.
So with the Fair Housing Act, the federal government said, we're drawing a line in the sand, no more. But now, how do those discriminatory practices persist today?
Well, in fact, the Fair Housing Act, despite its great intentions, has made things better, but really on the margins and gradually. I would say that it's had more impact on the actions not complete impact, but some impact on the actions of overt discrimination by realtors, overt discrimination by lenders. There's still all kinds of ways to effectively discriminate that the Fair Housing Act could get at if it was enforced more strongly. But also the Fair Housing Act hasn't been used to address things like exclusionary zoning and other local government practices that maintain segregation. And it really could be used much more aggressively. But in fact, in the last 2 years, we've seen the federal government say we're explicitly not going to do that.
Can you just dig in a little bit further on exclusionary zoning, how that shows up now?
Yeah, so basically exclusionary zoning is the effective prohibition of different kinds of housing, especially apartment buildings, smaller housing, more affordable housing in usually middle and upper income neighborhoods or especially suburbs. And so if you can't afford to purchase a larger home or can't get access to a mortgage and there's only single family homes for purchase, you can't buy into or get into that neighborhood. And there's all kinds of ways that local governments use exclusionary zoning to try to maintain a certain population mix.
Georgia State Professor Dan Immergluck is with us. We're talking about the impact of the Fair Housing Act full 50 years later. Well, there is a lot of data on the effect of living in racially segregated neighborhoods on health, on life prospects. What do we know about that?
Yeah, the phrase that's been, I think, popularized by NPR in particular is segregation in everything. We know segregation, concentrated poverty, has adverse impacts on school performance, has adverse impacts on health, has adverse impacts on how police treat people who don't look like the folks in their communities, and has long-term economic impacts in terms of basically allowing folks to gain education, skills, and access to jobs. We know through a program called the Moving to Opportunity Program that happened in the 90s, that when young kids were moved into neighborhoods with better schools, with stronger economies, that over the long run, they did better in terms of their adult earnings.
Well, Dan, I know you in particular have done some study and research on how, especially after the financial downturn, how the boom that has come back to so many Georgia cities and towns since then has been disparately affecting people of color and white neighborhoods. Can you give us a little summary of that?
Sure. What happened was black neighborhoods especially, but neighborhoods of color were disproportionately targeted with subprime high-risk mortgages. Those mortgages went into default at extremely high rates, far higher than anything we had seen previously. That led to vacancies, that led to a flood of housing available that the market couldn't absorb, and that led to a downward spiral of property values. When the national recovery came in about 2011 and after, those neighborhoods had a much harder time coming back, partly because they were hit harder, but also nationally, mortgage markets had tightened up a lot and it became much harder, especially for folks of color, to get a mortgage. And so that exacerbated the problem. And what we've seen is it's taken much longer for African-American neighborhoods in particular to recover, partly because it's been hard to get a mortgage to buy homes in those neighborhoods. That's getting better slowly, but it really made a huge disparate impact in terms of housing wealth for folks of color. And so many more folks could have bought houses if we had reacted differently, both when the crisis happened and afterward.
So housing wealth, how much people have in equity.
That's right.
And that's actually pretty divergent, even comparable houses in white neighborhoods or predominantly white zip codes, let's say, mm-hmm. and predominantly black zip codes.
Yes. So basically, we see much higher levels of housing equity in white neighborhoods. We see black neighborhoods housing equity really collapsed during the crisis. And again, until about 2015, 2014, it wasn't coming back. It is starting to come back now, and that's a good thing. But all those folks who could have bought houses at the kind of bottom of the cycle, many whites could, many blacks couldn't. And so we had a system that disproportionately negatively affected black communities on the way down and disproportionately benefited white buyers on the way up.
So the Fair Housing Act has changed somewhat since it was signed 50 years ago in 1988. It was amended to include people with disabilities and families with children. So you mentioned the 90s. There was a bit of a surge in mm-hmm. programs. But what has been the impact in more recent decades?
I think pretty much since 2000, we've seen a stalling of progress. The foreclosure crisis, the subprime crisis set us back, I would say, decades. And that was due to the lack of regulation of these private mortgages, subprime mortgages. So we have to basically create a system that doesn't allow private actors to exploit the discrimination in the private market. But we also have to attack exclusionary zoning, which hasn't been done. There was some progress at the end of the last federal administration to put out what were called affirmatively furthering fair housing rules. And those have been basically pulled back by the current administration. And they weren't dramatic. They were basically saying, localities, if you want federal housing funds, you need to examine where you are excluding people of color, where you are not furthering fair housing, or we might reduce that funding. And the current administration, despite its claim to want to continue fair housing, has put basically a hold on that.
Well, we want you to stick around. We're going to be hearing about situations for affordable housing in Macon from Grant Blankenship of GPB, and also just examining this idea of who owns affordable housing. I think many people in our culture think, well, affordable housing, it has a lot of old associations of housing projects, of, you know, not in my backyard, someplace else. But really looking at how it affects all of us, whether you can afford looking for housing yourself or you cannot. Just a minute before we wrap, any thoughts on that as we go into the break?
Well, the reality is for lower-income people, a great deal of affordable housing, I would argue a majority of it, is privately owned. The amount of publicly owned affordable housing has shrunken greatly and is continuing to shrink. I think that's actually a bad thing. But basically, much of housing by lower and moderate-income people that you see could be affordable housing. You wouldn't be able to detect it just by looking at it.
Well, Dan Emmergluck, he's sticking with us. He's a professor in the Urban Studies Institute at Georgia State University. Just ahead, what chance do you stand of getting public housing? And later in the show, an appreciation of the legacy of the late celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain. This is On Second Thought from Georgia Public Broadcasting. Stay with us. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. During the 1930s, Macon, Georgia was the nation's most redlined city. That term was not used until much later, but the practice, denying mortgage loans or municipal services that effectively drew a line around areas based on race or income, was common. Redlining is now illegal, but as GPB's Grant Blankenship reported in 2016, finding affordable housing in Macon and many Georgia towns is tough.
The asbestos was already being removed from Tyndall Heights by the time the politicians were ready to celebrate its demolition. Velma Dillard was one of the local politicians here to say goodbye. She serves on the local school board. Turns out she grew up here too. Dillard says once upon a time, this was the place to be.
A lot of good people grew up in this neighborhood. It was a launching pad for greatness.
These 400 or so blocky apartments built during the New Deal were radically better than the tar paper shacks they replaced. But by 1960, the wiring was out of date, and there has never been central air conditioning here. This is in the middle of Georgia. So Thelma Dillard was all too happy to pick up a sledgehammer, painted gold, of course, and take a turn knocking out a few ceremonial bricks.
I got it.
What will come next will be low-cost housing for senior citizens on about a third of the property and, should tax credits come through, a larger mixed-income retail and residential development on the rest. But first, everyone here has to go. So one day in October 2015, when this was still news in the neighborhood, I thought I'd see what people wanted when they left. Some, like George Neal, were indifferent.
It really doesn't matter. I'm just whatever I can afford, basically.
Some, like Diane Collins, didn't want to go.
I really got tacked to my apartment.
But most of the people I spoke with were single mothers with one thing on their mind.
I just want the best for my kids.
I just think it's time for me and my kids to move on to something better.
Well, it's going to be better because my son will be able to go to a better school. Well, the school he's at, it's okay, but I want more for him.
So, I think the easiest thing to do here is to sum up all these stories with the experiences of two women. I'm going to start with the voice of the woman you last heard, Auset Reeves. She's 25 and in school herself.
Me, I was already ready to move, so I'm excited about it, and I'm glad that they're doing this.
Luckily for Auset, she and everyone else here will have some monetary help. That would come in the form of a Section 8 Tenant Protection Voucher, or TPV for short. This is the help under Section 8 you get when your public housing is torn down. So what's out there for someone with a Section 8 Tenant Protection Voucher? I went to the internet to find out. I tried the Housing and Urban Development website and maybe found 8 apartments. Turns out that despite HUD being the place landlords sign up to take Section 8, they don't keep any sort of master list. The Macon Housing Authority keeps a local Section 8 landlord list, but that's available by appointment only. I've never seen it. So I searched other websites like GoSection8.com and GeorgiaHousingSearch.org. After a week or so, I had a list of about 195 properties. But remember, I'm a reporter who made this his job. Now imagine trying to do that if you're a working single mother in college. With Auset and the other moms I met in mind, I made a map of the properties I found by plotting all of them against school performance. I found most places were apartments clustered in the lowest performing elementary school zones in the city. There wasn't a single property in the highest performing school zone. 6 months after I first met her, I went to see how Auset's search was going. By then, the neighborhood looked like a ghost town, but Auset was still there, waiting to move to her new place.
It's a 3-bedroom house, and it's 2 bathrooms, and I love it.
She's been waiting for weeks to find out if the place meets the health and safety standards for using Section 8 vouchers. Just getting to this point wasn't easy.
It hasn't been like a walk in the park, like, well, you can go find this, then you get to move. No.
First, she had 60 days to look around.
Might not find something in 60 days, so it was like, I have to find something, like, as soon as possible, or, you know, I'm going to be real messed up.
And though Auset is happy with what she found, it isn't her first choice.
No, you can't get your hopes up too high. I know that we all happy about, you know, being able to move, but it's still like, okay, you have all these disadvantages of, you know, like, you find a place, and it's not in your amount, then that's kind of upsetting because, you know, all the good stuff is, you know, high, of course, the rent.
In Auset's case, what she can afford is to move her 9-year-old son to an elementary school with one of the lowest rates of literacy in the city. The school next to Tyndall Heights was better. It doesn't matter. She's still set on go.
It's really, I'm ready for a change. That's what it's mostly about. Ready for a change.
That was the last time we spoke. Of course, if more landlords took Section 8 vouchers in better neighborhoods, this would be easier. And when I talked to the then head of the Macon Housing Authority, she said they try to make that happen. But she said if landlords can't be convinced, the housing authority's hands are tied. So, Auset gets to move, and she gets a house, just maybe not the home of her dreams. But remember when I said I had two stories? Let's go all the way back to the demolition party at Tyndall Heights. That's where I met Tyra Ann Tate. waiting for her turn to swing the golden sledgehammer.
And I used to live in the building, the first building, when you pull in off of Richard Penniman.
Okay. She just left.
And I love my new place.
Where'd you go?
On the north side.
Oh, great. Cool.
Yes, on the north side.
The north side is Macon shorthand for the suburbs. Tyra Ann Tate made it out.
Hey.
About a week later, I got a tour of Tyra's new place. It's a row house on a street tucked between neighborhoods of single-family homes. Some you could call McMansions. The single best elementary school in town is half a mile away, accessible by sidewalks. With incense burning and reggae on the stereo, the vibe here is chill, especially out back.
You got a screened-in porch.
Yes.
That is so cool.
I get to wake up and look at the lake every morning.
Oh, wow.
Right. You see how peaceful it is out here?
Yeah.
Tyra has done nails for 20 years. She's been working hard to build clientele in Macon in the time since she came here from Cleveland, Ohio. When she moved into Tyndall Heights in 2013, she was newly divorced with three kids and homeless.
I didn't go in there with the mindset that I was going to be there long.
She'd been trying to leave for a while when she got the news about the demolition and the Section 8 vouchers. So she got to work.
We would just ride around neighborhoods, you know, get numbers, look on Craigslist, the newspaper, everywhere. Everybody just kept on showing us these garbage places. They were just terrible. I would actually want to ask them, would you put your mother in this place?
But Tyra knew what she wanted.
So I just refused. I refused to accept anything less than what I had in my head.
Then one day she was making small talk while doing nails for an old client. She talked a little about the house search. The client and her boyfriend were fixing a place up, told Tyra to take a look. She did, the same day.
And when I walked in, I was like, wow, I'm done. The search is over.
Except the landlord wasn't taking Section 8. Again, Tyra wasn't hearing no.
I just laid it down on the line, you know, to him. I just was basic and was like, look, me and my girls deserve, we need a place, a nice, safe environment for us to live. You know, we're all in school. We're, you know, we're good people. We won't tear up your house. And I know that's, you know, a stigma that people have with Section 8.
And he bit.
Yeah, he gave us a chance.
As far as Tyra is concerned, this is how the whole thing was supposed to work.
This is one of the reasons for Section 8, so you can upgrade your life. You don't want to go from a project to a slum.
Tyra Ann Tate says that just wouldn't make sense. For GPB News, I'm Grant Blankenship in Macon.
How about you? Have you struggled to find affordable housing in Georgia? Is the neighborhood where you used to live too expensive now? Leave us a message. We're at 404-500-9457 or reach us on Facebook or on Twitter. Now we're going to pick that back up with GPB's Grant Blankenship from our bureau in Macon. Hello, Grant.
Good morning, Virginia. How are you?
Very well, but really interested in that story. And thanks so much for updating it. I know you reported on it earlier. And more recently, you've been reporting that the tax reform championed by President Trump passed last year, in effect now, could stall low-income housing. How so?
Okay, so decades ago, the federal government said they would build no more public housing. And what they've been doing since then is awarding these tax credits to your public housing authority. Those are the people who, or your local housing authority, that's who actually builds public housing. What they do, they take these tax credits and they come to corporations who maybe feel like their income taxes are too high. And they say, for money invested in our new public housing project, our new construction, we're going to give you a cut in your income tax rate. And that worked well for a long time. But the new tax reform, that cut corporate tax rates a lot. Mike Austin, he is now the head of the Macon Housing Authority. He sums up what that means.
How about you summarize what Mike says?
All right. So what Mike said, he put it really succinctly. If I'm corporate Joe, that was his term, I'm paying 37% tax rate, and all of a sudden it's 20%, you know, are you going to need these tax credits anymore? And that's what the fear is across the country. These corporations don't need low-income housing tax credits, and so there go the funds for public housing renovation. So Mike Austin here in Macon has already had to get a loan from our local urban development authority to muscle through this last phase of development at Tyndall Heights. And I think he's expecting to have to do the same for the next phase.
And you're going to be following some people, Annie Johnson, somebody in Tyndall Heights who now lives in the Tyndall Senior Towers. What are some of the other stories that you're following having to do with housing in Macon?
Right. Well, so we're going to continue to watch the redevelopment of Tyndall Heights, to see that thing through all the way to the end. By spring of next year, we'll know if the Macon Housing Authority is able to move these tax credits on the open market and secure funding to really cap that thing off. And the capstone there, and this is the plum everybody's been waiting for, is not just senior housing for Annie, as you just mentioned, but also mixed-income housing, family housing, a place anybody and everybody can live on the grounds of the old Tyndall Heights. So fingers crossed. We'll see if it happens.
Well, a lot of stories, and we'll be listening. GPB reporter Grant Blankenship in Macon. Thanks so much.
Yeah, no worries.
50 years after the Fair Housing Act was signed, banning racial discrimination in housing, we are exploring cost and availability of affordable housing. And over the past couple months, we visited cities and towns across Georgia where the post-recovery development boom is changing the availability and landscape of housing. Popular perception and plenty of data support the idea that housing discrimination remains a prevalent problem in the South and across the country. So with us today are a couple of people working with organizations on the ground aiming to change that. Bambi Hayes Brown is president and CEO of Georgia Advancing Communities Together. Good morning, Bambi.
Good morning.
And we also have with us Eric Provitt. He is staff attorney with the Atlanta Volunteer Lawyers Foundation. He's also a fellow at the Georgia Housing Corps. And Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We've got Dan Immerglock. These guys are working on the ground. Dan is also an on-the-ground researcher, but he is the professor at the Urban Studies Institute at Georgia State University. And he is helping us get this a little bit of data perspective on what we're talking about. Dan, great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for sticking around. So, Bambi, you've spent the last 20 years working on housing in communities around Georgia. What types of discrimination do people still face?
Unfortunately, people face all types of discrimination as it relates to race, disabilities, as well as income discrimination, as you heard from the stories.
Yeah. So how does that show up for people like Osset and like Tyra? Are they not able to find housing in the first place?
That is correct, especially for the Housing Choice voucher holders. They because you have the prices of the rental homes that are going up, they're so expensive right now. And where landlords previously would rent a house for $400, now they can rent that same house on the regular market for $1,500. And people who have those Section 8 vouchers, they're having harder and harder times to find those affordable units or find landlords that will take their Section 8 vouchers. And then, unfortunately, their time will run out, and then they are now at risk of losing their voucher. Even though they can file for an extension with their local housing authority, oftentimes the time still run out, and then that family and oftentimes are left looking for alternative housing arrangements, such as living in extended stay hotels or doubling up with friends and family.
Mm-hmm. A lot of that going on. This is happening for, you know, people in the middle class. They feel like they're getting priced out of neighborhoods. So never mind people who are in the low income bracket. Eric, you're the Georgia Housing Corp. That's a fairly new program. That's what you're a part of. So what are they doing to help people in this situation?
And so the Georgia Housing Corp is a unique program in that it was kind of birthed out of a settlement between Bank of America and the Department of Justice. Uniquely and together, we're focusing on different areas of preserving affordable housing in the state of Georgia and throughout all of Georgia. I work with tenants. We have people that are working in criminal justice and property rights. So it's unique in that sense.
And you're a lawyer. So
I am,
this is
most
this
days
is,
at least.
So this is actually a program to help people with legal aid. It's not just seeking housing.
It's not. And so we actually, my fellowship focuses on individuals that already have housing, and I'm working to preserve that by protecting them as they go through the legal process. And so we provide free legal representation. We also advocate for clients if landlords aren't fixing the things that they should under the Georgia Code.
And Dan, we heard a historic perspective from you earlier, but that idea that there was no protection for people so often, these cases just ended up in court. Is that the place where things are still legislated?
The kind of 30,000-foot view in terms of whether the Fair Housing Act is enforced is definitely tied to courts, and in particular, this issue of disparate impact, whether if you do something as a lender or as a landlord that looks race neutral but has a strong racial impact, like not accepting vouchers, whether you might be held accountable under the Fair Housing Act. That's been a huge problem. There was some progress over the last few years in extending, particularly since the Supreme Court ruling in 2015, that disparate impact and housing discrimination would be given more weight. But now, again, current federal administration is starting to pull back on that commitment.
So, Eric, we just have a minute until the break. Are you seeing more of this action in this current administration because there have been fewer protections?
Well, we focus on state court action, so it's a bit different than the federal laws. But wholly, you know, looking and yes is the short answer.
Well, we're going to take a bit of a break. Bambi Hayes-Brown is with us, Eric Provitt and Dan Immergluck. We're talking about the Fair Housing Act. 50 years later, is it delivering? Is it fulfilling its promise of fair, indiscriminate housing here in Georgia and really across the country? This is On Second Thought. Stay with us. This is On Second Thought from Georgia Public Broadcasting. I'm Virginia Prescott and talking with a number of people today about fair and affordable housing. This is 50 years after the Fair Housing Act was signed, banning racial discrimination. Well, you can't go far in Georgia these days without hearing people talking about how much building is going on, how expensive it is to live, and a lot of gentrification. That's one of the things that we heard oftentimes traveling across Georgia. And we're digging into that a little bit, especially about fair housing practices in terms of discrimination with Bambi Hayes-Brown, President and CEO of Georgia Advancing Communities Together. Eric Provitt is with us. He's a staff attorney with the Atlanta Volunteer Lawyers Foundation working on federal housing. And also Dan Immergluck is with us. He's a professor in the Urban Studies Institute. That's at Georgia State University. So I'm going to pick this up again. Bambi, you've been president and CEO of Georgia Act for almost a year now. What have you found some of the most effective ways to support fair and affordable housing here in Georgia?
What I found is some of the most effective ways is definitely dealing with systems change and policy change. And we need that throughout the state of Georgia, in your rural areas, in your suburban areas, as well as your urban areas. I know the city of Atlanta started with an inclusionary zoning passing of the ordinance where developers must include a certain percentage of affordable housing units when they build those units. However, it doesn't go far enough. We definitely need more affordable housing units. We also need preservation of our existing affordable housing units for both renters and for homeowners, and advocating for that policy change on the local, state, and federal level, looking at increased funding for voucher holders, for people who are senior citizens, those who are disabled, those who are at or below 30% of HUD's median income, which are disproportionately affected by the affordable housing crisis. Advocating on our state level for stronger landlord-tenant laws. Unfortunately, Georgia is not very friendly towards tenants. So looking at strengthening those laws to assist tenants who need not only affordable housing, but who also need healthy housing.
Well, this is a long list. You've got a big job in front of you, obviously. Yes. And we've heard from in Atlanta, the developers of the Beltline, initially they were going to set aside a certain amount of units for affordable housing. That wasn't deemed to be enough. There was a push for more. Why is it so difficult to create affordable housing? Eric, what have you seen?
So I'm not sure that it is difficult. I think it just takes the will. And so if we work and we operate in a capitalistic society, the least and the lost are often not thought of. And so if we have those advocacy groups on the ground that are pushing the powers that be, I think that's what creates the change, along with good lawyers that are willing to file good lawsuits.
There you go. And that's the business that you're in here, helping out people to advocate. And this is something you've been doing a great deal with on Atlanta's west side. Can you tell us about the community that you serve there?
Yeah, so I work inside of a school, Hollis Innovation Academy, where I support the students as well as the community in Vine City, English Avenue, AUC in Ashview Heights. And so we're working to prevent displacement and prevent gentrification by keeping legacy residents in the community.
Eric, you were a mortgage lender before you became a lawyer. This is a big career change.
Not things that I like to talk about.
Well, we won't get to that. We'll leave that. But tell me about your perspective and how that has changed in the time in between from trying to not lending in many cases money to people who needed it for housing and now advocating for them.
And so I think the biggest change is the perception of individuals that live in the communities that I now represent. Prior to my working in the neighborhoods, I had a view of what folks that were renters in neighborhoods like that, what their model was or what they looked like. And I'm coming to find out that it's about as far from east as west is from my perception, 5-10 years ago, in terms of what actually exists today.
So, Bambi, this is something you've been working on. One initiative was in the DeKalb County Housing Authority Veterans Affairs Supportive Housing, or VASH, program. So that is something that looks like it's been a success. Why do you think that's been a success?
Well, I think the main reason why it's been a success is because you had two federal agencies working together, which previously was unheard of. And they were able to break down those barriers and work with the local VAs and the local housing authorities to provide those housing for our veterans. And along with that came supportive services, which I think was a very important piece, whether it was substance abuse issues or mental health issues that the veteran faced. The Veterans Administration was able to address those issues. And then as a part of my duty when I worked at the DeKalb Housing Authority was to transition those veterans into permanent housing. And I did have one veteran to transition from homeless to home ownership. And I think that was a very telling story and a great success. And we would like to see more of those.
Yeah, so that can happen. It does happen. And when it does happen, how does that affect a person's life going forward?
It affects a person's life going forward in tremendous ways, not only with the family, with the education for the children, better education opportunities, better health indicators, better economic indicators, because we know that a large proportion of African-American wealth is tied to home ownership. And so it's a win-win for everyone involved when we're able to help people attain affordable housing.
Bambi Hayes-Brown, president and CEO of Georgia ACT. Eric Provitt, he works with the Georgia Housing Corps Fellow. He's a Georgia Housing Corps Fellow and staff attorney. And Dan Immergluck, professor of urban studies at Georgia State University. We're going to take a hard turn now, but I want to thank you so much for filling us in. The late celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain changed the way that a lot of people think about food. He traveled the world for a CNN show, Parts Unknown, and took us along for the ride.
It's the capital of Kenya with 6.5 million people living in the metro area. Metro Manila, bustling, sprawling Southeast Asian capital of the Philippines, Seattle, a city with a collective identity constantly in flux. Nightcap at a chef-friendly establishment known as Octopus Bar in East Atlanta. I am unbelievably, in spite of my world travels, new to the wonders of the Waffle House.
Bourdain killed himself in June while filming Parts Unknown, but his legacy remains, and that final season of the series debuted last night on CNN. So with that in mind, we invite a couple of people, friends who worked with him and were inspired with him by him to join us. Freelance photographer David Holloway worked with Bourdain and joins us from New York. Hello, David.
Hey, how are you doing?
Very well. Really happy to talk about Bourdain. And we welcome executive chef of Five Church Atlanta, Scott Lee Innes, is with us. Hello, Scott Lee.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Well, he's wearing his Kettle One and Soda breakfast shirt for us today.
Yes.
Really glad to have you with us. So tell us first, David, how about you? How did you come to know Bourdain?
I worked with him a couple of times on his first show, and it was just coincidence. I wound up working for CNN just before he started working there. And, you know, I reached out and said that I was interested in the show, and he wasn't letting a lot of people work on it. And he invited me on a trip, and then he told me I could stay.
Well, that's the best kind of invitation you want. How about you, Scott Lee? How did you meet him?
Well, I guess when he came to Atlanta and did his tour of different restaurants, such as the Octopus Bar, I was the executive chef at Ormsby's restaurant. And, you know, like Ormsby's is a speakeasy restaurant slash bar. And, you know, he snuck in by himself and, you know, just played his normal self. And that's how I met him.
So chef to chef, that must be a pretty amazing thing that you were working there. And then in Saunders, Anthony Bourdain.
It was mind blowing to see the late, great Anthony Bourdain, the legend, as I call him.
What impressed you about him? I mean, this is a guy covered with tattoos. He's very steely in a way. He can be withering in his criticism. Was he a warm person?
Very warm. You know, a lot of celebrities, I'm not going to say nowadays, but a lot of celebrities are not personal people. So he was warm, welcoming, and, you know, great conversation, down to earth. You know, he loved his beer and, you know, just let him know how great it was to have him in our presence.
Well, we did get some tape from a 2000 interview. This is for WBUR's Open Source radio show, and he's making a prediction about his future as a celebrity chef.
For me, the heroes are line cooks. I mean, this book was written from the point of view of the line cook in the trenches, you know, not somebody with their own show on the TV Food Network. You know, I will never have my own show. You would be very foolish to make me the host of a show on the TV Food Network.
So there you go. His prediction obviously didn't make it. David, you are a photographer, and apparently Bourdain hated having his photo taken, never mind being on TV.
Yeah, it's
true. So what was that relationship like?
Well, the first time that not the first time I shot him, but one of the first times that I was traveling with him and I shot him, it was like a funny situation. I worked with a lot of people that don't want to be photographed before, but I just was like, hey, this is really a great scene. Can I shoot you over here? And he kind of hemmed and hawed and rolled his eyes. And I was like, look, you're the one wasting time. And he's like, okay. And we went over and I just fired off five frames. And was like, okay, thanks. And I turned around and walked off. And later in the airport, I was like, hey, thanks for letting me come. And he said, no, thank you for being the most expedient photographer I've ever met. And so it made a difference. You know, he was always happy to see me. He was always, I told him, I go, look, I'm not going to ask for a lot, but when I do, like, it's going to be worth it. And so he was always willing to say yes.
Well, he always was willing to say yes as a traveler, it seemed to. I mean, I remember, you know, watching him eat like sheep's eyeballs and last night on the show drinking blood wine, remaining curious and hungry on all of his different adventures. In an interview with NPR, he talked about how often he chose eateries that weren't famous but known in local communities.
The response I'm looking for is to hear from someone from the neighborhood saying, how did you ever find that place? I thought only we knew about it. It's, you know, truly a place that we love and is reflective of our culture and our neighborhood. But on the other hand, that's kind of a destructive process, because if I name the place, and I don't always when it's a place like that, I've changed it. The next time I go back, there's tourists. There's people who've seen it on the show. And then I might hear from the same person from that neighborhood saying, you ruined my favorite bar. You know, all the regular customers have run away and it's filled with, you know, tourists in ugly T-shirts and flip-flops.
Okay, so he did open up the world of those, I guess, tourists in flip-flops and T-shirts. But how did he change the views of American food and travel, do you think?
The way he changed, just like you said, went to the unknown places that, you know, locals like me indulge on a daily basis. I never forget when he came to the Bronx. You know, I was born and raised in the Bronx, and he went to local restaurants that I actually went as a kid and growing up. So he made it known to the world, you know, you can find the diamond in the rough. And he basically just inspired everybody to, you know, just search, just come out your realm and to search for something different and not the most well-known areas of the world.
David, would you say a similar thing, that this opened up a way of not just eating, but looking at the world?
Yeah, Tony was kind of like a contemporary Frommer's or Lonely Planet. People really trusted him to be their guide. And traveling all the time, even after his death, I found myself in Peru recently and just sitting in a coffee shop, and I start talking to a few other people who are obviously American travelers, and nobody knows what I do. And the conversation just turns to, you know, when Anthony Bourdain was here, you know, this is what he said. And that happens everywhere. You know, I've been in, you know, dozens of countries, and it's always possible to run into someone who's there and they're using Tony as their guide.
Did you both watch last night's episode from Kenya?
No, I didn't get to.
Oh, it was really lovely. There's apparently this is his last that he completed with his signature, you know, scripted narration. Let's hear just a clip from that.
I do my best. I look. I listen. But in the end, I know it's my story. Not Kamau's, not Kenya's, or Kenyan's. Those stories are yet to be heard.
Anthony Bourdain from last night's episode of Parts Unknown seems especially poignant to me. And watching him last night, just a kind of generosity of spirit. And Dan Immerglick, who sat down earlier, said, you know, my son just fell apart after he died. What? So many people who didn't know him. Scott Lee, you knew him. Both of you knew him. David, you knew him. Why did it affect people so much?
Well,
Tony was relatable. He was honest, you know. When I think about what Tony was to me, he always felt like a cooler older cousin. He knew that I wasn't as cool as him, but he was going to help me. You know, he's going to steer me to keep me, I don't know, being more interesting. And I think that he did that for everyone. If you watched the show and it inspired you or connected with you, like that's him. That's really him.
What do you think,
Scott Lee? It's his voice.
Scott Lee.
You know, he's just a down-to-earth, you know, individual. Even with his status, you know, he will walk the normal streets as, you know, every single person in the world. He made everybody feel comfortable to be around him. You know, just gave everybody that inspiration. And, you know, you weren't always perfect, but you can better yourself off, you know, as long as you put your mind to it and stay focused and stay well grounded. And, you know, he just made everybody feel warm welcome.
Is there a recipe that of his that you love that you're going to keep cooking in his honor?
Always, especially, you know, the book Kitchen Confidential. You know, when I first started to read it, you know, I thought I would be able to just read one chapter at a time, but I just couldn't put the book down because it's like you were basically living your life through that book as a upcoming chef, a line cook, just the daily struggles that we go through in the kitchen, restaurant industry. No one knows.
Scott Leonis, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Scott Leonis and David Holloway, freelance photographer, both friends, both knew and loved and were inspired by Anthony Bourdain. You can catch the final season of Parts Unknown Sundays at 9 on CNN. There are more details on our website, gppnews.org. That's all we have time for today. This is On Second Thought from Georgia Public Broadcasting.